Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Research at the National Archives and Beyond Blog Talk Radio. This is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and joining me today is Dr. Ellen Fernandez-Sacco for a conversation about her article, Bound to History, Leoncia LaSalle's Slave Narrative from Moca, Puerto Rico, which was part of an interview back in 1945 by the historian Luis Diaz Sola. Now, he interviewed Miss LaSalle, a 112-year-old woman, and her 85-year-old daughter. Now, Dr. Fernandez Sacco is going to tell us about this article that she wrote based upon the slave narrative. And so she has some very interesting information to share with us. Now, let me just tell you about Dr. Fernandez-Sacco. She is an independent scholar whose current work focuses on the genealogy and family history of people transitioning into freedom after 1870 in Northwest Puerto Rico. Her work integrates the family history and genealogy of people of color, cultural and class-based differences. So she's going to tell us more about the account of what happened to Miss LaSalle during enslavement based upon this interview that historian Luis Diaz-Sola had with her. So let me just give a warm welcome to Dr. Fernandez-Sacco. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you so much, Bernice. I'm so happy to be here. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about this topic.
Oh, well, I'm really looking forward to hearing about this topic because, I mean, you're expanding our knowledge. And so tell us more about what does your article, Bound to History, cover?
Well, the article is covering basically two large topics, and one of them is about the condition and the access to the archives that we can get to recover information about enslaved ancestors. And then the other part of it is to work on Leoncia LaSalle and her daughter Juana Rodriguez LaSalle's slave narrative, and then kind of filling that out, that history, with their lives in this small town in Northwest Puerto Rico.
So when you mentioned, you know, about their lives, just tell us, what did you pick up in the slave narrative about the lives of the mother and her daughter?
The account itself, it's an embedded account. By that I mean it's published within Diaz Soler's book. So he takes the account down in 1945. And she relates, both her and her daughter relate the story about what the conditions were for their enslavement. And she begins it the way a lot of slave narrative begins, where she says, I was raised on the hacienda of Don Marcelino Lasalle, way out in the countryside of Moca, and that she worked in canes since she was very little. And she goes on to describe the, you know, meals, really scant meals, the kind of violence that she had to deal with, the different kinds of situations that she was faced with as a young woman coming of age working on a plantation. She talks about an experience of being sold or actually being exchanged to, in satisfaction of a debt, which is how she is transferred to another enslaver in Lares, Puerto Rico, which is an adjoining municipality. One thing that I'm really struck by is that when she tells us this kind of experience, that's very hard to track through paperwork then. You know, this sounds like a very informal exchange that happened with her. So she had been coerced or raped or both by the son of the plantation owner and had a daughter. And she speaks about that. She speaks to that in the condition of women being of sexual exploitation happening and the kinds of situations that women would find themselves in trying to get support for them and their child. And, you know, she says that one thing she would have wanted was freedom for me and for my daughter, and that he never gave me, which to me tells me that there's still a chance that I may be able to find her sedulous in the my current project, which is transcribing these documents, which were used in emancipation to inventory enslaved people, so that the people who owned them would be indemnified for anywhere from 125 pesetas a piece. So they would be getting something, whereas like the people who are coming out of slavery are faced with a whole host of difficulties. They don't have any kind of political rights for 5 years. They can't buy land. They don't work for any. They work for free for 3 years until they're declared officially free. So there are a lot of really negative things, and her account doesn't really get into that. It's very brief. But what it does though is that it counters these other kind of really pernicious narratives that come around that are told around slavery, where because the numbers in Puerto Rico aren't the numbers of Cuba or Brazil, people would argue that, oh, you know, it wasn't a bad situation. And in reality, there's just as much violence and cruelty, because violence is what you need to maintain a slave system. And so then reading this account gives us, you know, it's a testimony. It speaks against the grain in terms of what some people might have tried to put forward in the past. With some of the accounts that Díaz-Soler did, what he did was position this account against some earlier accounts from the 19th century to kind of say what was going on and how this would speak against that. The other importance of this for me is that this connects her account with the experiences of millions of other people. And in that doesn't make it isolated. And I think that makes it something that we can all learn more about.
Well, it does sound like it's something we could learn more about. Now, when you're trying, let's say you're reading these narratives, what kind of primary sources would you utilize to try to track what's going on with her or her enslavers?
Well, we've got basically three different sources that we can depend on, which are the parish records, the slaves inventories. There's one from 1820. So there may be another later. I'm not sure. And and then protocolos notariales, which are the notary documents, which are housed at the Archivo General de Puerto Rico. But there's a problem with those in that they're considered living documents, so when you use them, you can only use them in very limited situations. You know, you have to go and take each page and copy it out by hand. It's not like they've opened up the access necessarily. One thing that really helped was Carlos Encarnacion Navarro about 10 years ago, he actually published several of the protocolos from this early time period. And from that, I was able to extract information on various enslavers that were in the region of Aguadilla, northwest Puerto Rico. So but this is all familial. This is similar to the South in that, you know, we're dealing with families. You know, mm-hmm. It's a familial process. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And, you know, you mentioned the difficulty as far as accessing the records. Have you found any records on FamilySearch or any other online resources, or do you actually have to go to Puerto Rico to the archives and the notarial archives to find some of these documents?
Actually, right now, online is the best resource. They're really... There were a number of churches that did not agree to the microfilming of records by FamilySearch. So there's also a kind of delayed digitization project that the Sociedad de Puerto Ricana de Genealogía, the SPG, is now working on, which is mm-hmm. getting those records and trying to get that digitized before they're lost. Trying to get information is not the simplest process. So that's the other reason why I'm working on this transcription of these cedulas, because the volume, Ancestry has the 1872 Registro de Esclavos, and it mm-hmm. says, you know, that it's 100% and it's on full pre. But what they don't tell you is there's 33 different municipalities don't have volumes, that they don't have records that were turned into the volumes that are currently on there. But some of that original information still survives, so that I've been working on transcriptions of that. And it's really enlightening, because there's you find a lot of ancestors on both sides who you may not have been aware of being mm-hmm. involved in trading people or being enslaved themselves. So I've been working with some people who have been reconstructing their family history as a basis of that too.
All right. Well, kind of help us, give us a... idea of the arc of time, let's say from 1800s to 1945 when the interview took place. Help us understand what was going on in Puerto Rico and other places that would have an impact on slavery.
Sure. So if we think about it, it's really not that long ago. And I think one of the things that we could look at that spanned a lot of profound shifts is that, you know, start with the uprising in Saint-Domingue, which is 1794 to about 1804. And with that uprising, a lot of the enslavers who had plantations were forced to leave, and they wound up going across the Caribbean and selling different places, from going to New Orleans and Baltimore, and then finally settling in Puerto Rico. And that's kind of what happened with the Las Salles family who left their plantations and apparently had some records to continue their business. So two brothers arrived in Puerto Rico in the 1800s. And that's kind of the beginning of a new phase in plantation economy, because Puerto Rico is shifting from kind of like a military outpost with some crops and some plantations, but really moving into sugar and coffee during the 19th century. So, and during that time, plantations started to get smaller, and that really started to grow over the course of, after the 1850s, they started to get even larger. In 1872, we have emancipation. The process of emancipation started in 1868, where there was an inventory began on the enslaved people in Puerto Rico, and then that continues through the 1870s, and it really doesn't end until about 1886, and then you have the civil registration, the Registro Civil, which is probably the best source for people's lives after 1885 begins. You have the end of the slave trade in Puerto Rico and Cuba in 1886 also. And then just 30 years later, you have like the Spanish-American War and the rise of sugar on the island. It really becomes more of a corporate entity. Corporations come in from the United States and they start buying up and expanding the sugar plantations on the island. There's some coffee, but it's much less. It's really kind of devoted to a monoculture. And then mm-hmm. in 19, you know, we have the Spanish-American War in 1898. And then after that, 1917, Puerto Ricans are granted United States citizenship, although it can be argued it's a second-class citizenship. But they're granted citizenship, and that gives mobility for a lot of people. And then by 1945, in 1918, you have a lot of Puerto Ricans who served in the First World War, which is an argument for why we got citizenship in 1917. And then in the Second World War, at the end of the Second World War, is when Díaz-Valero winds up going to Moca and interviews Leoncia and her daughter Juana.
You're right. When you listen to this arc of life, you know, it really has some profound shifts, but it really wasn't that far away. When you just said, you know, emancipation was 1872, but it really wasn't the end of slavery until 1886. So it's just helping us get the context of what's going on here, and the fact that the interview was possible, and she was 112 years old. So, I mean, I can imagine the information that was shared. Well, tell us, I understand that you have a goal, a project. And tell us about this project. What are you trying to do?
I'm trying to think about her in terms of a legacy. What does this testament mean for us and for, you know, and to hear this voice coming to speak to this experience, you know, I think it's really an important moment because we don't have other people's voices, but we may have fragments of that from people's family histories. And I really encourage people that if anybody has any little bit of this experience in their family, to definitely interview your elders and write whatever it is down, however little it might be. You never know when all this stuff starts to come together. The other thing about it is that very much like people in the American South, they had to navigate a lot of legal constraints. So even though she was a woman and she had her daughter, I mean, she still had to support herself. And what she and a lot of women like her did was to move away from the plantation. Some people even left the immediate vicinity of where they were enslaved, which is completely understandable. But what a lot of people did was then move into town and then work in the service industry, where they would, some of it is doing the same thing you were doing before. It's you're a lavandera, you're washing clothes, or you're cooking for people, or you're taking care of children. But the difference is that the time is in your hands. You know, you have control over your existence. So all of that kind of local networking is really kind of very interesting to me, because a lot of times when a history of a town is written, these are not the people who are talked about. These are not the people, right. But this labor is the labor that keeps things going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So then how do you get people in the community to, first of all, acknowledge that enslavement was in that community, and then how do you get them to start sharing what they have heard?
I try to do that with groups on Facebook also, and try to do that with the, I have a Sociedad Ancestros Mocanos, and I have another group on the history of and genealogy of slavery in Puerto Rico, and trying to get people to realize that this could be parts of what their history is. And I don't think that anybody necessarily negates it, but there are, and I'm not sure exactly what the conditions are right now. I know that there's a lot of interest in it, and there's a lot of people who are involved in tracing their family. With the Lasalle, for example, that family was one of the larger slave owners in Moca. And as one of the largest enslavers, what would happen is a lot of people would take the surname, and it would be almost like an identification where people would know that that's, you know, either by kin or by location, they would know that there's a connection there by the surname.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that. And there are a lot of people in the Lasalle family who are working on their family history now and working on these kind of different branching family trees that are connected in one way or another to this former plantation. So for instance, I don't have Leoncio's mother's name. I don't know who that was. I'm hoping I might find her cédula because it would probably state on there who her mother was, and fill in the details that way. But there's a lot. There's a lot of little bits to bring together.
Sure. So why does the legacy of Leoncia and her daughter matter?
I think it matters because we're also dealing so the extant slave narratives. There are two that come out of Cuba. One is by Manzano. And it's a very poetic account by a man, but more often than not, you don't really hear women's voices too much in terms of either the Caribbean or the South America. So I think it's a really kind of a rare thing, but the real importance is in its view of its resistance and its stance on surviving, and claiming a place in society.
I get it. So what are some of your future plans, and what do you want people to, if they could be of assistance, to help you with what you're doing?
I'm really, I think that community-level research is something that's really starting to kind of take off, and I have a lot of that. My experience with Black Progen has been amazing and taught me a lot about different aspects and different approaches and different ways to kind of get to recording experiences. And looking at like Nika Smith's Trash 250 project, that reconstructs the paths of ancestors sold across different states, this stuff can't be done alone.
Right.
So I would like to see a kind of separate database for Puerto Rico with all of the information that we can possibly collect on enslaved ancestors. I would love to see something like that develop. Too often what happens is that it gets lumped in with Cuba, and Cuba is so, in my mind, kind of a really distinct experience than Puerto Rico because of the concentration of people and the extremes that were kind of constant there. There were extremes in Puerto Rico too, but the numbers are different, and you also have a large population of people that don't always accept that they are people of color, that they do have African ancestry, that they do have this as part of their existence. I mean, there's a whole argument around identifying, I call it Afro-Indigenous ancestry, because you can't separate that history from the beginning. We have helped each other escape the powers that be who attempt to exploit people. So I think it's very complex. It's complex. And what I'm seeing also in this 1870 cédulas, I'm seeing that, people are way more mixed than what people have ever anticipated, when you go through it. This is really not a black and white story at all. Definitely there's, colorism can definitely affect things and stop things or for some people make it like a border, but that's kind of like, I think that's changing. I think now people are more open to this history and exploring it more.
And so how can people get in contact with you? And also tell us about your Latino Genealogy and Beyond page.
Okay. My blog is Latino Genealogy and Beyond, and I started it about 4 years ago, and I've used it to kind of jump more into depth in episodes of Black Progen that I've worked on, and also to look at different aspects of different moments in slavery and history, the history of slavery in Puerto Rico in different locations and different time periods. So there's something like 30 something posts now. And what I would like to do now, what I'm working on now, is getting that some of those posts into a book.
Wonderful.
Yeah. And I continue. And if anybody's interested in learning how to explore their ancestry, or how do you do this, or I have, or trying to figure out how to pull these pieces together, to please reach out to me on Facebook or on through my website, or you know, email me. I'm not hard to find.
Well, Ellen, I want to thank you so much for coming on. You have shared a piece of history that perhaps we all have not been aware of, but I look forward to just looking at more of your research and articles that you're writing. I mean, you're kind of the trailblazer to help others learn, and I know that what you have shared with us today is important. It's insightful. And for everyone else, I want you to remember your ancestors left footprints. And, you know, Ellen was talking about a slave narrative that was written in 1945. Well, look, there's slave narratives out there that perhaps we all need to look at, and also need to look at primary sources, some of which Ellen said she may have some access problems to. But what I want everyone to know is that you can tune in, you can contact Ellen, find out more about her project, and let's just keep this going. Okay, everyone? And Ellen, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. So this is your host, Bernice Alexander Bennett, and I look forward to all of you joining me next week. Bye-bye, Ellen.
Thanks, Bernice. Thanks so much.